Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Thank you for downloading and listening to this episode. Coming up on today's show, an interview with Cheryl Sullivan, president of Demand Tech. She's going to talk a little bit about pricing structure, but also about 2021 predictions, including retailers potentially doubling down on private label goods. We'll also discuss Kroger and a positive looking ahead story where Goldman Sachs issues something that's cautiously optimistic regarding 2021. A reminder, you can like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you like us, those ratings help other listeners to find out about our show. Additionally, you can check us out on social media at Retail Podcast. We've got a jam-packed month of December coming your way, including a show we'll talk about coming up on Wednesday, a couple of interviews in that one, another interview for this coming weekend's show. So a lot of great content coming your way in December. So if you haven't yet, make sure you hit that subscribe button so it goes directly to your podcast listening service each time we release a new episode. Now, as I mentioned, our lead story, we haven't discussed them since their Q1 earnings call, is Kroger. Now, they had an earnings call this week, but as is so often the case, you know, Kroger's earnings calls are a little bit about finances, but especially the prepared remarks, they're mostly just a PR statement for Kroger. They talked a lot about different initiatives, the Restock Kroger campaign, of course, about keeping their associates happy, but we dove a little bit deeper to look at some trends that might be affecting the rest of the grocery industry mentioned by those on this call. And, you know, typically in a week where Dollar General also releases earnings, we would tend to cover Dollar General, but we've been keeping a close eye on grocery sales of late on the podcast, and we wanted to continue that trend. And another reason we thought it germane to cover Kroger here on this episode, Cheryl Sullivan's going to talk later about that increasing momentum in private label, and that played big into this quarter for Kroger, so we felt like it dovetailed rather nicely with our interview with Cheryl. And the other thing is IBM data is showing planned grocery spend from shoppers is up 5% year over year for Q4. By the way, Carl Haller will join us next Wednesday. He's from IBM to talk about their data from their Home for the Holidays report, but it's interesting because that's planned grocery spend. And something that IBM points out is that planned spend is always different than actual spend. And if it's up 5% planned spend in the fourth quarter, it may in reality be up double digits, which is exactly what we saw in Q3, and something that might play out with the rest of the grocery industry as well, not just pertaining to Kroger. Now, as far as Q3 is concerned, Kroger beat analyst expectations. Analysts were more bullish on Kroger than they've been on most retailers, expecting earnings per share of 66 cents. That actually would have represented a 40% increase or so over last year. But as it was, adjusted earnings per share came in for Kroger at 71 cents, so a modest 5-cent beat. Operating profit as a whole was up to $792 million in the third quarter of this year from $254 million a year ago. But the big number we've been watching for most grocers is same-store sales, comp sales, identical sales, whatever you want to call it. That's the big number we've been keeping an eye on over the last 3 months, and we've seen those numbers come in at an increase anywhere between 5% and 14%, depending on the retailer, depending on the micro-segment that they serve within grocery. Kroger came in towards the upper end of that, excluding fuel, as we always do. Identical sales for Kroger, which is what they call them, identical sales, they were up 10.9%. Now, I mentioned that's towards the upper end of what we've seen. If you were to plot out maybe the mean and the median, Kroger would be beating both of those because we've seen the median come in for grocers at high single digits there. Now, the exception that comes to mind is Albertsons, whose quarters are offset by about a month. They actually reported Q2 comps up 13.8% back in October. But again, because that's offset, it's not an even one-to-one comparison with Kroger. But still, Kroger's comps on the upper end of what we've come to expect from grocers. And we should mention some retailers have yet to report, at least the publicly traded ones, for the most recent quarter. Ingles is one of those that comes to mind. But back to Kroger, the growth in comps, so we talk about that 10.9% increase, came as a result of growth in all departments. They were asked on the call which departments were doing better, and the answer is honestly all of them. Of course, some departments grew more than others. Meat and produce were the main winners here. Something to note is that Kroger has been doing a lot of marketing regarding their Krogies and the Fresh for Everyone campaign that we talked about when they launched it last year. But the point is that Kroger is not only messaging this fresh portion of their business across to customers, but they're also providing incentives and discounts. If you've got the Kroger app, or if you're a rewards member, or whatever they call in your region that rewards card for Kroger, you've probably noticed a slew of coupons for produce and meat specifically, something in the neighborhood of $2 off a $10 meat purchase or $2 off a $10 produce purchase. So again, you're looking at that going into Q4. That didn't take place as much in Q3, but they are really wanting to drive home this messaging. But also, one has to wonder, you know, there's market share available in this area because the increase in sales of raw materials like produce, like meat, that's been spurred likely by a continued reduction in restaurant business, even more so now in the fourth quarter, and then a resultant increase of people cooking at home. So Kroger sees market share to be had in this area, and they are trying to capitalize on it, both via marketing and via promotional activity. Now, the cadence of improved comps through the quarter, looking at the entire business, was steady, meaning, as they said on the call, in fact, there weren't any significant U.S.-wide spikes in demand. You know, we've all seen the videos on social media, certainly, of stores being raided for bath tissue and the like. Kroger said, hey, that's more localized. We're not seeing any U.S.-wide spikes in demand, and that's continued here into the fourth quarter for them. Digital sales, meanwhile, contributed about 4.6% to that comp increase, which is obviously a positive for Kroger. Overall, they were up 108% over last year. Now, Kroger was especially happy with their alternative profit business growth, something they've been particularly bullish on for the last 2 years or so. They've talked about different ways that they can bring in money, a lot of it meaning leveraging the fact that they have contact and close contact with so many customers. And even their digital media revenue has tripled compared to last year, something we talked about specifically with Paul Brenner of Vibonomics about their initiatives with Kroger and assisting them with driving alternative revenue within store digital media. If you haven't listened to that podcast with Paul on, I highly recommend you check it out because it is directly related to what Kroger's talking about in this quarter, where they're seeing a massive boost in revenue and basically pure profit in this area, not only in terms of digital media, but also in terms of marketing. Now, Kroger as a whole also updated full-year guidance, which we haven't seen a whole lot of from grocers in general. They figure full-year identical store sales will come in after Q4 at an increase of 14% even. Now, as far as call notes are concerned, since we've talked a little bit about the numbers, perhaps the most notable information came at the beginning of the call. CEO Rodney McMullen noted that this past quarter, e-commerce sales were actually incrementally profitable, which is something that retailers are striving for, especially those that started as brick-and-mortar natives. Digital non-traditional revenue, like we just talked about, certainly played a part in that, but McMullen noted that their operational efficiency has also improved greatly over the last year. And that was taking place even before COVID because they were putting a lot of investments towards their digital strategy, which certainly paid off for them. In fact, when COVID hit, you'll recall Leighton and I talked about on this very show the fact that they had a greater percentage of their overall locations set up for buy online, pickup in store than Whole Foods, which is owned by Amazon, company most people think of as being tied in directly with e-commerce. Now, part of Kroger's operational efficiency is likely due to scaling up of their digital initiatives as well, and more customers using those. As more customers have used them, they've been able to make those processes more efficient. That noted, they actually feel like they can enhance digital profitability going into calendar year 2021. And again, like I talked about, many retailers have been wringing their hands about what to do regarding squeezing profits from e-commerce sales, especially with this proverbial race to zero. Kroger did the same thing in Q3 with a lot of discounts and a lot of promotions regarding picking up and home delivery, because pressures are mounting out there to offer free pickup and free or reduced price last mile services. Now, when pressed in the Q&A, and an analyst, of course, asked the question, hey, how profitable was the digital business and how much in terms of pass-through are we seeing? Neither McMullen or CFO Gary Millerchip would put a dollar figure on it. And part of that was because they said, look, we don't know where the profitability lies for e-commerce versus where it would typically lie because of COVID impacts muddying the waters. Now, they did say that the pass-through rate on e-commerce sales, dollar for dollar, versus brick-and-mortar sales was lower. Brick-and-mortar sales, the pass-through rate's about 15% for Kroger. For e-commerce sales, probably somewhere in the 10% range, they said. But again, brick-and-mortar's pass-through rate has been incrementally lower this year as well because of extended COVID expenditures, increased pay to staff, and of course, increased cleaning mechanisms within the store. So COVID impacts just kind of making everything a little bit messy to where it's difficult for them to pinpoint an exact number and parse that out. But Kroger did say, at least their CFO, once again, Gary Millerchip, said on the call, costs were higher for e-commerce orders as a result of paying the order pickers, with the exception of the occasions where Instacart does the picking for them. Although in those cases, they're also losing a little bit of money because they're compensating Instacart. So it's a balance, as with everything, but the more e-commerce orders come in, the more efficient those order pickers can be when they move through the store. And as a result, you're going to see that pass-through rate increase. At least that's what Kroger feels like going into the end of Q4 and on into fiscal 2021. Now, once again, as we noted, the company credited private label development for their momentum in building their grocery market share in the U.S. They did gain market share this quarter, according to Kroger's internal metrics. During the third quarter, Kroger launched 250 new items, which set a record for the company. Around 20% of these new products were in the Simple Truth plant-based line, which in and of itself saw over 50 items launched. And we have talked ad nauseum on the podcast over the last several years about the momentum in this portion of grocery, but they're also seeing sales pay off for it. The Simple Truth brand for Kroger, their natural and organics line, grew nearly 15%. That is inclusive of their plant-based products. Sales of their private selection brand rose 17% year over year. In particular, McMullen noted private label growth in packaged produce, fresh prepared foods, and specialty cheese. Once again, you're looking at produce, meat, and dairy as the big drivers for Kroger, even in private label growth. And of course, when McMullen mentions specialty cheese, that's indicative of their in-store Murray's counters. Now, 5 years ago, when Kroger's purchase of Murray's came down, we wondered on the show just what kind of presence Murray's would have in stores, or why Kroger saw fit to bring Murray's in under their wing. But evidently, their increased build-out of specialty cheeses in stores throughout the U.S. over the last 5 years, that's been met with acclaim by customers. And this is also an interesting example of private label as gourmet. Remember, third-party data, we talked about it on the show, does indicate certain shoppers are increasingly looking towards gourmet products. And this is something that we'll ask Cheryl Sullivan about here in just a moment. Now, another topic of conversation was supply chain. Some grocers, again, see a slight uptick in regional panic buying or pantry stocking or pantry stuffing or whatever you want to call it, with restrictions in various areas tightening. Now, they noted that they've been able to procure an additional 5,000 truckloads of inventory in anticipation of demand ramping up. McMullen also said that they are putting and being proactive about putting quantity limits on certain high demand products. They also took the step of increasing distribution capacity reserves by 20% within their supply chain in preparation for the holiday season. So what this has meant in some cases is shifting product sourcing for some stores, because certain DCs, distribution centers, had effectively reached capacity, so there wasn't that additional 20% to give. So Kroger has had to adjust which stores are sourcing product from where on the distribution front, moving around the distribution map, so to speak, in order to optimize space at some underutilized DCs that they had in their system. So I found that interesting, is that in the preparation for Q4, from the supply chain perspective, Kroger's actually moved around where certain stores are getting their product simply because they want to be sure that if, again, demand ramps up during this second, third, whatever this wave of COVID is, they want to be able to fulfill all of those products. And I've got to say, I've visited Kroger stores, basically three different brands in three different time zones over the last couple of months, and stock has looked very strong from that regard. Especially you look at the paper products, you look at meat, you look at produce, you look at some of the products that were in really high demand during the course of the first wave of the pandemic back in March, all really pretty strongly in stock at Kroger stores. And something that management said on the call is they said, hey, West Coast is a little bit different simply because COVID impacts are greater there and there are more shutdowns in that part of the country. But generally speaking, in-stocks look fairly good for Kroger right now. Finally, they were asked on the call about inflation, something that, you know, pre-pandemic, we always talked about in terms of grocery. We really haven't discussed it over the last 9 months or so. Miller Chip said that generally they built their pricing assumptions for this year around 0.5% to 1% inflation for food categories, but they're actually seeing closer to 2%. Of course, part of that driven by the pandemic, but you're also looking at certain categories like meats, certain categories like grains have become in demand a little bit. However, a reduction in promotional pricing for Kroger in certain categories, that's actually helped somewhat in terms of not directly passing this increase on to customers. They're being a bit more selective about where the promotional pricing is hitting. And they noted that going forward, because of COVID-based unpredictability, they have to revisit where to pass inflation on to customers on a product-by-product basis. They're having a difficult time looking ahead to say exactly where things will fall in terms of grocery inflation in 2021 and how much of that will be passed along. So again, they're going to use their pricing models and they're going to revisit this basically on a product-by-product basis, as demand suggests. Now, speaking of those pricing models, that's a great segue to Cheryl Sullivan as we spoke with her, the president of Demand Tech, not only about pricing, but also some predictions for the 2021 retail year. With the calendar turning to December, it's time to turn our eyes to 2021, and with 2021 approaching, it's only right that we begin to explore retail projections and predictions for 2021. Today, our focus is on pricing, consumer price sensitivity, and private label penetration, and what brands are doing to push their private labels out onto shelves. And here to discuss those topics with us is Cheryl Sullivan, president of Demand Tech by Pustic. Cheryl is an expert with over 30 years' experience and has assisted retailers like Safeway, Hold Delays, Home Depot, Walgreens, Michaels, PetSmart, the list goes on and on with their pricing and promotional strategies. Cheryl, welcome to the show. Glad you could join the podcast today.
Thank you, Trent. It's great to be here.
First, I gave you a brief introduction, but I'm also about 99% sure I didn't do your career and background justice. I was wondering if you might share with our audience a bit about your experience and focus areas in retail.
Yeah, sure. As you mentioned, I've been doing this for a really long time. I think I've worked with just about every major retailer and CPG company in the world over my career. My emphasis has always been more on the demand side. So a lot of experience around category management, pricing, assortment, space management, kind of that side of the world.
All right, excellent. We'll touch on a lot of those topics here during the show today. Now, one of the things I wanted to mention is, you know, again, we're talking about 2021 predictions. And one of the things that I know you've noted is that consumers might continue some of this price sensitivity we saw ratcheting up during the summer months. It's interesting because customers generally were price sensitive before the pandemic, but we really saw that ratchet up during the first several months of the pandemic. And I was curious what type of dynamics you're seeing surrounding price sensitivity that we might play out next year.
Yeah, so you're 100% accurate. Price sensitivity, first of all, has always been there. And just when you thought it couldn't get worse, it did get worse. And just to put some perspective around that, Demand Tech did a recent study that we commissioned Progressive Grocer to conduct. And what we learned from the study was 61% of shoppers viewed themselves as price sensitive And they expect that sensitivity level to rise even going into 2021. So, you know, if it wasn't already hard to compete in retail and get those prices right, you know, you've just elevated that to a whole new level. On top of that, I should add that not only are they price sensitive, but there was a lot of damage done through the first wave of COVID. I'm sure the second wave of COVID is going to impact it more, where I think retailers didn't know how to respond to shoppers and that increase in price sensitivity. And it resulted in just erratic pricing. And the way that that was viewed by shoppers was more unfair and gouging. In fact, I think it was 3 out of 4 shoppers felt that the pricing was unfair that retailers were putting out there. And 55% of them said they encounter price gouging. So now you've got a hyper price sensitive shopper that also you have no loyalty or trust with anymore going into 2021.
Some interesting findings there with that Demantec and Progressive Grocer survey, and kind of keeping in the grocery space here. I know last month we talked about on the podcast some third-party data that saw a push by certain consumers, not all consumers, but certain consumers in terms of trading up, at least for groceries. So you have 61% of consumers that are price sensitive, but also a subset of consumers that might be buying more gourmet products. Is it possible we see something of a barbell effect play out where consumers that are unaffected financially by the pandemic find themselves maybe with more money, more discretionary income to play with, while others are seeking to budget a bit more?
I think it depends on the vertical, what I'll call retail vertical, you know, whether it's grocery or fashion or electronics or something like that. I do know the biggest impact of COVID has been on some of that discretionary spend, which is why you see, you know, unlike grocery, where there's been a huge uptick in sales for grocers, you've seen these other segments like fashion and such take a big hit. So I don't know. I think this next wave of COVID and this, you know, what we learned from shoppers, which just said across the board on every question we asked them, they predicted to get worse. I don't personally think there'll be a lot of trade up. And I know there will be a trade up in grocery. So in fact, I think it's kind of the other opposite effect. So you mentioned earlier private label. You know, private label is growing, and it used to have a stigma associated with it. The, you know, national brand was always better. But I think what COVID has done is it's really pushed people to try more private label. And we all know private label, in many cases, is made by a national brand company, CPG company. So they've learned that that's not trading up. That's really kind of at par. So in talking with some of the shoppers, the data we got from the survey was 7% increases expected in shoppers to purchase the private label over the national brand. So that should be a kind of a wake-up call for the national brand. So that sensitivity of, hey, I'm not getting quality, has gone away. And even if it didn't go away, part of the other things, and I've been part of numerous studies around where shoppers view price compared to a bunch of other variables, whether that's quality or availability or free shipping, all kinds of factors. And it has consistently, study over study over study, including the last one, ranked number one, especially in grocery. It definitely got a huge bump when it comes to grocery.
And regarding grocery, we know the likes of Kroger and Albertsons Safeway have seen an uptick in private label brand penetration, even prior to COVID. But it seems like since the pandemic, it's not only assisted grocers in increasing margins, but it's assisted others. For example, home improvement, we've heard private label has become big during the pandemic a little bit. Now, my question is this, in terms of, and you mentioned you've worked a lot with helping retailers optimize shelf space and the like, in terms of finding that appropriate shelf space balance between private label and those national brands, what are some key factors that retailers must keep in mind during 2021?
Yeah, so, you know, we live in a world of omnichannel. So if you go online, it's endless shelves. And if you look at all the momentum going on in grocery, especially with Amazon and others, that's always been a fast-growing sector, but the whole COVID impact has just, I tell people to take the training wheels off of many people who never dare venture out into the buying food online. But it definitely, like, there they have endless shelves. Yes, they have challenges around you know, DCs and stuff like that to be able to source that food. But it is growing. It, in the stores is where you're really constrained to a specific amount of space. It's really like when you are determining your space allocations and even your assortment, one of the key factors that go into the analytics, or I'd even say science, especially when you look at like planogramming and floor planning and things like that, is price. So my question is, well, what price are you using? And I think the challenge for retailers is you've got to be using the most consistent price, and it needs to be based on some form of science and needs to be predictive, because you can't, it used to be you set your shelves using average 52-week pricing, 52-week movement, 52-week sales, you know, and that's not our world anymore. Our world is you've got to predict what's going to happen. So I think if they are doing that, if they're using some form of prediction, if they are taking in the most accurate pricing, I think you will see the recommendations coming out of a lot of that kind of technology really centering to give more private label space to the shelf. And I think that becomes even more challenging, freezer, cooler doors, things like that, where you can't just, you know, put it on an end cap or put it on a different aisle or something like that. You know, especially if you also look at, like, you know, who's really making some momentum in the market, the Aldis of the world, they're almost predominantly private label. And even with Amazon, I think people think private label is kind of this ticket for them to gain a lot of market share.
So while we continue talking about shelf space, at least for brick and mortar retailers, what were some of the things that brick and mortar retailers maybe learned during the first wave of COVID surrounding shelf space allocation, especially for those items that you might see panic bought? And again, you mentioned price gouging also playing into that. What are some lessons that they learned that they can take into 2021 with kind of this second, or depending on who you're listening to, the third wave that we're in now?
I think that retailers, the COVID impact, they weren't prepared for where the demand was going to happen. And so it doesn't matter how financially sound you thought your shelf was. Every shelf that gets set, we always know that it's a blend between art and science. And, you know, you can't just have your store look all chaotic in order to fit your products. There has to be some rhyme and reason to it. You've got to have blocking and certain brands together and all these pieces that come into it that bring that art side. What results from that, even before you get going, is you've got areas of overstock, areas of understock. And again, like, what data did you use to set it? What COVID did is it changed the world. It changed what items were even considered key value items. And most retailers understand that key value items are those handful, just a handful of items that drive a disproportionate amount of price perception. They're items that shoppers very well know. And like we said, they will be super price sensitive on that. That's also a competitive type of product as well. So KPIs normally stay pretty stable. And what they're not doing nowadays is staying stable. They are shifting. Who would have thought, you know, yeast would become, you know, a KPI item, you know? So these shifts, I think they weren't prepared for. And even most of the technology that they're leveraging isn't sophisticated enough to handle those shifts and be able to dynamically adjust in either real time or near real time. And when you look at shelves and that whole arena, like, those are set, you know, they kind of set it and leave it, and then they do these ins and outs. So it wasn't too much of a surprise to see, you know, the significant out of stock condition, and then also the inability to get those shelves replenished properly, especially with the reduced staffing. I mean, it was just the perfect storm. I do think that they're getting a handle on it, but I think what was pre-COVID doesn't exist anymore, and those KPIs will continue to shift. So from the pricing side, they need to be leveraging something like what we have, which is all around, you know, leveraging science to, you know, constantly monitor the situation and being able to make, you know, price changes based on a number of factors. I think on the shelf, you know, when you're trying to do the shelf in a store, a physical store, that's a little harder because it's more of the ins and the outs, and you only have so much room in the store. And the biggest impact in the store has also been labor and how many people you could even have in a store at a time. So I definitely think there are big challenges ahead on the space side and the assortment side, But, you know, we're pretty excited that on the pricing side, you know, there are quite a few, some of the largest retailers in the world are customers of ours. And those are the ones that did quite well. And they knew how to dynamically adjust the pricing on their items. I will say our tool helps the assortment, you know, or the shelf, but it can continue to read those real-time demand signals and make those dynamic adjustments.
I want to pivot a little bit in terms of retail segments, because we've talked quite a bit about grocery and other segments to this point. But in particular, as it pertains to private label, we know that according to Forrester data, market share for private label in pet products, particularly pet food, has actually gone down by about 300 basis points in the last decade. Now, given the fact that you've worked with PetSmart, other pet retailers in the past, I figured we could bring in your expertise here. Why is this the case? We know generally that people prefer to spend money on their pets even above their own family in some cases, but what can retailers do on the pricing front in terms of marketing to ensure that customers find that those private label pet products are of high quality so, again, it can help those retailers achieve the margins they're looking for?
I can tell you as a pet owner, an avid pet owner, you know, I only feed my animal a certain amount of food or a certain type of food, and I'm reluctant to change. It's all about the strategy. So it's not like changing prices. It's all about, you know, every item in an assortment plays a different strategy. It's about the end game. So if you go all the way back to, you know, even when category management was first introduced, in a way it was moving away from an item, managing at an item and managing at a category level, because what you do with one item can impact several items. And the goal is I want to grow my category. I want it to be profitable. And I want that across my entire store. So there is that, how do I get shoppers in the store? Right. And that's often, you know, there are people know which items typically are what they call destination categories that would drive somebody to the store. But it's also from a promotional front. That's what promotions are heavily centered. And I'm going to give you something, but I'm not just going to give a loss leader. It's because that how I price that or promote that is going to drive purchases of other things in the store. So it's about having that all those strategies, right? So if I take pet, for example, you know, I may leverage dog food or cat food or something like that, that, you know, tends to be a destination category, and I might get them into the store, but I know when they're in the store now, you know, right next to that dog food, I've got pet toys, things that are margin driving, not traffic driving. So there are items play different types of strategies. And that's also an area where retailers get tripped up, because they often think they're playing a certain strategy and therefore they're trying to align everything against that. But in reality, they're not. And I would say those strategies have even gotten thrown up in the air as now that we've been impacted with COVID. So it's about building, it's about pricing your entire assortment based upon what your strategies are, and that can help you achieve those strategic objectives, but also exceed those financial objectives as well. So if they're not selling and you're pricing it right, so the pricing tools would look at the demand, it would understand who's shopping, you know, who's your consumers are shopping, which exact stores, which exact items. So this science works at a store item level. It would know what competition's out there, what the pricing of the competition is. So it takes a numerous amount of factors into consideration when it tells you what to do with the pricing. It's not going to just keep saying, reduce it, reduce it, reduce it, because it's not selling. That's something that on the assortment front, if you've got an item that's not selling and you're pricing it optimally, maybe pricing's not the problem. And I think that's getting to what you're saying. Maybe it doesn't have reviews. We all know the products without reviews, you get very, very low conversion rates. And with just one review, that conversion rate skyrockets. Price is one piece, but you've got to have everything else working properly too. And I would say if it's not moving, it's priced optimally, maybe it's an item that should be discontinued. We have pricing that could help you with that too, on how to optimally build that markdown plan. When do you take the first mark? You know, when you take the second and the third, how deep do you go to balance that inventory with those updates? So it's just a matter, we call it a life cycle of price. So, you know, whether it's initial price or now I got an everyday price, or I'm gonna throw some promotions in it. And then there's that end of life and I need to build that plan to optimally clear it.
So I wanted to finish up here because we're looking at, again, things that are happening, things that are increasingly happening heading into 2021. And you mentioned promotional activity, and we've seen retailers take a number of different stances regarding promotional activity, some rolling it back almost entirely during the heart of the pandemic, some increasing it a little bit where they need to. What are some key factors that are in play regarding retailers' decision making into that promotional activity as we head into 2021?
Yeah, I would say this is the biggest pain point for retailers. So first of all, shoppers have just grown accustomed to promotions. They've also grown accustomed to wait for a promotion. I think in our recent study, it was 34% of shoppers said they were extremely or are likely to wait for a promotional offer. So we're not in this world. I always tell people that eventually there will not be an everyday price. It will be what is the price, and it will be some form of a promotional discount. Moving us in that world of also one-to-one. I think what retailers have done historically is they like to repeat promotions. And I don't think what most of them understand is you could have a few good ones, and then you most likely have more bad ones. And so the bad ones are going to cannibalize the good ones. And so really didn't achieve the objective, or they're not looking at it from the perspective of the halo and cannibalization effect. You know, you might promote something, but it didn't cannibalize something else. So therefore you're no further ahead. Or did it drag something? Did it go and drag and grow your basket? So getting the right promotion, you got to do them. But getting the right one and leveraging it as a tool to grow your category, grow your basket, grow your store, et cetera, you got to get the promotional offer right. And, you know, that was one thing that we noticed too. And again, I've been involved in study after study around this. And historically, shoppers really like the percent off and the dollar off, and the one that always fell to the bottom, way down in the bottom, was BOGOs. They didn't really like BOGOs. And what we saw, a paradigm shift in that, to where now they're telling us, you know, I want a BOGO. Like that's the one that ranked number one. In fact, 54% of those shoppers said, I want a BOGO. What they don't want is buy two, get one. They don't want to buy quantities to get it. They just want buy one, get one. Perfect. And then it's followed by dollars off and then percent off. So just since COVID, and there's tons of different promotional offer types. And depending on who you're reaching, most likely those are different too. So it's really, this is another area where we try to help, which is, you know, making sure that as we're, I think from the very beginning, from at the point that a retailer is negotiating, I'll say, or working with their CPG partners, because CPGs fund a lot of those promotional offers. The problem is they don't necessarily come up with the best offer. Retailers don't have anything on their side to understand if it's the best offer, and then they move forward with it. And then that's a no-win for anybody. Shoppers don't want it. Retailers didn't get anything for it, and the CPGs lost a lot of money. So it's really about starting at the very beginning and making sure that when those trade funds are on the table, that those promotional offers and the use of that trade fund is as most effective as possible, and that the funds are being applied on the right brands, but also the right offer type. And then, you know, you got to carry it all the way to the execution, that when you're deriving that offer, are you deriving it for cat buyers, dog buyers? And then how are you then executing it from the standpoint of, you know, is it buried in your flyer somewhere, or did it warrant a major ad on the front page, you know? And then, by the way, are you also putting on your end cap? And then what about your website and social community? So the planning is critical. The execution is just as critical.
Some fantastic insight. Once again, Cheryl Sullivan, president of Demand Tech. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks, Trent.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we thank Cheryl once again for joining us and bringing her longtime expertise to the table on the podcast. Now, in our Looking Ahead segment, as I mentioned, some positive news by way of Goldman Sachs. And it's not really the news itself that's positive. It's Goldman Sachs outlook that's positive. In fact, they raised their 2021 GDP estimate, but also pointed out that the amount of consumer savings and the amount of household savings have generally increased during the course of the recession. This is for various reasons. People either intentionally socking money away because they're worried about pandemic impacts, or they're just not spending money on travel and entertainment and food as they were, say, in 2019. So they have more money to sock away. And we know, and we've talked about, depending on the research that you look at, about a quarter to a third of U.S. households have been adversely impacted financially because of the pandemic. But even still, customer savings and customer excess savings have gone up. And assuming, Goldman Sachs says, 50% of this excess consumer savings is spent over the next 2 years, it could potentially create a bit of a boost for retailers. Now, again, we've also heard that the minute the news of a potential vaccine came out, people were making travel plans. Airlines saw a bit of a surge in terms of traffic. Priceline saw a bit of a surge in terms of traffic. But I think one of the main things that you have to look at here are some of those non-essential goods or some of the gift goods that you're seeing. And in fact, I want to go back a couple of weeks ago to Dollar Tree's latest earnings call, because they said consumables across their organization was actually down. Discretionary was up at Dollar Tree. And granted, that's a dollar store, so maybe people are convinced more to purchase discretionary items at a dollar store during the course of the pandemic. But I think it's going to be interesting to watch how those discretionary categories potentially move in 2021 and 2022. Is that something that more people move towards? Do they begin to, again, use that savings on things other than travel? Are they still a little bit leery of travel, entertainment? We know movie theaters probably aren't going to be the same after the pandemic, especially with all the online or virtual releases. Or does that money go somewhere else? Does it go to in-home digital media? Does it go to travel, indeed? Where does that money go? And I think this is a big question the retail industry has to ask. And in this circumstance, retail is competing against other categories that are out there for these dollars that have been saved during the pandemic. So I'm going to be watching everything from retailers, of course, from marketing to the type of products that they're promoting to customers to their buying, and seeing if buying maybe is a little bit different for certain retailers, knowing that people might have this excess money to spend. Or could it be option three? Could people just continue to sock away money, worried about maybe pandemic number two coming around the corner or some other unforeseen incident? Well, we don't know, but that's why it's part of our looking ahead segment. So I'm going to be keeping a careful eye on discretionary spend at retailers in 2021, and more importantly, how retailers court that discretionary spend to try and get people to empty out the piggy banks, not entirely, but just a little bit. Well, once again, we thank Cheryl Sullivan for joining us on the show. We thank Leighton Kling for working behind the scenes. I'm Trent, saying so long until Wednesday. We've got Vidya Peters on from Marketta. She is going to discuss their recent survey regarding digital wallets and share of digital wallet use, certainly something that's top of mind for retailers. And as I mentioned, we'll talk with Carl Haller of IBM regarding their latest report and holiday sales. It's called the Home for the Holidays Report. We've talked about holiday sales projections a lot on this show, so we're going to go with a bit of a different angle. We're going to talk to him about how they found customers might be more likely now to shop based on their values and their system of values than potentially other factors. So I think that's an interesting interview, a couple of them. And then coming up next weekend, we're actually going to talk about confectionery retail with Keith Cohn, who is the founder of Candy Club. They have their product in five figures worth of retail doors nationwide. He's going to talk about the way things are right now in candy retail, as well as dynamics to watch in the coming years. So three great interviews for you next week. I certainly hope you listen to those shows. And until next time, so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.